Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Welcome to another edition of Spin the Rally Pod, Dirtfish's very own podcast. I'm David Evans. You might have noticed already it's quite quiet. That's right, there is no Lisa O'Sullivan, no George Donaldson, and no Colin Clark this week. I'm alone, apart from the man on the other end of the Skype connection, and that is the one and only Derek Dauncey. Derek was team manager at Mitsubishi Rally Art through some of the team's most successful years, through those four dominant years of Tommy Mäkinen winning back-to-back championships. Derek has now, of course, moved on to become team manager at Hoonigan Racing, Ken Block's own team. But for years, Derek and I have talked about, Derek has told me his remarkable stories, just amazing stuff. And we've never had time to actually sit down and do it in a fairly structured fashion. So we've decided to do that. Time is on our side right now, as we know. So this is the first of what I hope, as long as I can keep Derek on side, the first of a few interviews that we're going to do together, just to get out some of those incredible stories. You know, the 1990s for a lot of people is some of the, you know, it's the best, it's absolutely epic World Rally Championship action. And that was when Derek was at the height of his power with Mitsubishi, and when Mitsubishi, of course, was at the height of its own power. So let's just jump straight in, shall we? We are in 1996, I think, Derek, and we're going straight to the Safari Rally, which was, it was a big event for the team, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. It was a bit of a pivotal event for Mitsubishi. Initially, the Japanese side of Rally Art had basically gone and competed on Safari for like 6 or 7 years with Kinjiro Shinazuka and the Tusk engineering team. And they were fully supported by Mitsubishi, but it was a massive effort. I mean, the boys would go out before Christmas and do, you know, two complete recces of the route, which is a much bigger route back in the early 90s. And they'd struggled to actually get a result there against Toyota and Lancia, who were very strong and spending massive money.
How much would you have spent compared? I mean, we all know about these incredible Toyota stories, you know, of them hiring facilities out there for 6 months and blah. What was yours compared with that? Was it anything like that effort?
It wasn't on a budgetary side. I would say we were probably doing it for a third of what Toyota spent. When we went out there, what happened was we, in 96, in late 95, Mr. Kimata had discussed sending a car out, one of our cars out, to support Kenjiro. And in 95, 96, Kenjiro still continued the same philosophy of going out doing two recces, and we turned up and did a 10-day test before the event. But we took enough stuff for that single car to probably, you know, we weren't going there to be second. We were going there to try and do as best we possibly could for Mitsubishi. You wanted to, you know, they had set targets. They wanted to win Monte Carlo. They wanted to win Greece. They wanted to win Finland. They wanted to win Safari. They wanted to win Rally GB. That was the five main target events in theory. Obviously, they wanted to win everything else, but
yeah,
they were very, very important events to Mitsubishi. So this endurance event for the brand was important. You know, Mitsubishi had a strong presence with the Lancer in the country as a road car, which is an upgraded version of the Lancer with different bushes and everything. So we went out there with Tommy. Tommy had come across to us the end of in 1995, and you know, everybody within rugby were quite keen to do it. Andrew Cowan had obviously done Safari in the past and been successful and done endurance stuff. So yeah, we decided to do a two-car effort, and I must say it was one of the most challenging events. Safari for me was Safari in Hong Kong, Beijing were the two challenging events of the year in theory. The others, the Asian Pacific Championship and the World Championship, were tough. But we went to 96 with with some of the team members that had done safari before, but also it was very fresh to a lot of us. So we went into it with we took a European gravel car, and you know, upgraded top mounts, and the front chassis rails were reinforced and double skinned to take the bull bar that you see on the front of the car in case you hit a wild animal. Mm-hmm. But like the Japanese had gone there with double skin floor, and it was ridiculously heavy car, and we'd gone with a glorified gravel car which was beefed up.
So when you say the Japanese, that was the Tusk engineering car, that was Shinazuka's car, was it?
That's correct. Jiro Shinazuka, and those boys, you know, they'd done Malaysia, Indonesia, Ivory Coast, Safari, you know, they'd done all the rough events out in India and Malaysia and Asian Pacific round. So, you know, very good team. Shoji, the tall Japanese engineer, unfortunately died a couple of weeks ago, but led by him on the mechanical side, and Mr. Shigeru. So,
yeah.
You know, we had a very good relationship with them anyway. So yeah.
They did their own cars, Derek. They didn't take parts from rugby, from Rally Art and Rugby. They were based in Japan, and they were quite a separate entity to you.
Yeah, completely. I mean, Shinazuka's car was right-hand drive. So, you know, there wasn't a lot of crossover parts, apart from that they took the the magnesium rear uprights and the cast front upright from Japan, same as us. And then they'd modified the front cross member to suit the right-hand drive car. But, you know, they're on a different damper, different tyre, different philosophy in some respects. So when we turned up there, you know, they looked at our car and in a nice way, they kind of laughed, I would say. It's probably the best way of saying it. They didn't think we were going to laugh. It was going to last. And, you know, the exposure for the event was a long time. I was there for 6 weeks in preparation. And then we had a 10-day test. And we had a 6-day recce. And the recce and the test crossed over each other because of some development stuff we were doing. And then you had the rally itself. So it was a long, long event.
Your first time there?
Yeah, my first time there. I've done some work with Cord Sport, but I didn't actually go to the event when I prepped for Safari with Cord Sport because we had so many other programs going.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Glenn Edmonds, the local contact, we used the Simba Colt Mitsubishi workshop. They were really good to us. And that was our base, and it was like you're almost trying to replicate what you have at rugby back there to make all the boys feel, you know, at home. The laundry service came in, the food was delivered of a night time. You know, it was like an encampment, a small army in theory.
It is a culture shock though, isn't it, when you go out to Kenya for the first time? You know, nothing, for me it was the biggest. You know, I've been to all of the flyaway rallies, but Kenya is still the one where you think, wow, this is another world at times.
Yeah, and you know, it was different in the early 90s, but like mid 90s, there was no British radio, no English TV. The colonial side was still slightly there in some respects. President Moi was the president, and you know, he was the biggest landowner in Texas, so there was still a lot of poverty in the country.
Yeah.
But a great knowledge of the safari rally that was always run at Easter. So, you know, everybody in the dog knew what you were there to do. So friendly and believably friendly people. And, you know, as I said, Mitsubishi were brilliant to us, Mitsubishi Motors out there. And, you know, back in those days, you could deal with British Airways, and you could go and check everybody in without passports. You could get a passport to go, a pass to go airside to meet your air freight. You know, everything's completely changed now. But everybody was super, super keen on the rally and help out what they could.
Yeah. Just to whiz back to the car, yours was, as you say, a converted gravel spec car. How did that compare to the Toyota? Theirs was a ground up safari car, is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think it was probably more developed. I mean, from our point of view, we chucked a fair bit at it from trying to be clever where we spent our money. But like the first day of the 10-day test there, you know, it was kind of a bit of a cultural shock. Mm. We actually came back to the workshop the first night thinking that we'd got an issue with the dampers, and the dampers were squeaking really badly as we're driving along. You could notice here like a like a really bad metallic on metallic sound. Go back to the workshop thinking that, you know, okay, we're going to have to try and fix this in the field, but fix it so we can carry on the second day of the test. And then we had a close look, and you could put your hand up in between the floor where the cross member was and touch the fuel tank, the actual back of the car completely split in half. So it meant the first night that we had to take, you ran a 125 litre tank. So you can imagine that's 125 kilograms of weight plus a spare wheel in there. And that broke the back of the car. So unfortunately, the first night was an all-nighter, taking everything out and using half a reel of welding wire to stitch everything back together again. And then we were back out the next morning running.
That's incredible. And that's a proper sort of baptism of fire, isn't it? That it makes you rethink everything safari, those old spec safaris, because they were so rough, weren't they?
Oh, I mean, it's quite kind of crazy. I mean, not that year, we took an engineer, an engineer from the team, I won't say who it was, and he actually point blank refused to go down one of the test roads because he thought it was too rough. And it was McGarty Road was always our base test road, and we went back there every year because you had a base knowledge of what you'd done the year before.
Yes.
And you know, we came back, we put him in the car. I said, look, the best thing to do is go in the car with Tommy, and he'll show you, you know, where we're roughly at. And there was a massive ravine in there that Tommy would always take flat out. So, but the strange thing, one of the key factors of the event for us in '96 was, we'd been working with Pekka Siltanen on a damper. We'd used the Japanese dampers. They hadn't worked, even in late 95 at Rally GB. We had a lot of problems with rebuilding dampers overnight. And we went to Safari that year with Pekka's, Siltanen's Finnish engineer's design, with Öhlins making the parts. So it was a bit of a hybrid Öhlin stroke Pekka damper. Which was highly successful. I mean, we flew out to the event with a set of dampers. We put them on the test car, which had already left Rugby before the dampers were complete, and took the car around the back of the workshop, and it floated on the rough surface.
Really?
So, yeah, so we kind of, you know, you have like an aha moment.
Yeah.
It really felt like a bit of aha moment. And we went back into the shop, and it was back in the days before mobile phones. We phoned, trying to get a telephone line back to the UK to speak to Roland Lloyd, mm-hmm. and tell him that, you know, okay, we need to go ahead with what we can with these dampers, because the two sets we had a set and a set for the test. They definitely were a step up, not just for Safari, but as a global damper improvement. 50-inch shocker tube. The valving was different, the way that the blow-off worked inside the damper was different. But, you know, for the rough conditions out there, straight away, we had a bit of a tick in the box. Yeah. So it was a massive step for us to try and achieve what we wanted to do. But it moved a few of the problems that we saw during the test onto, you know, things like the rose joint bearings. The fibre linings would only last maybe 50, 60 kilometres before they started banging away. So we'd gone through this whole circle of moving problems around the car and having to fix them in the field and coming back with different solutions. So it led to us changing the philosophy of the event, where I think many people probably remember that we started to change every corner of the car at every service. And that was driven by a necessity to try and keep the rose joint bearings intact and the suspension geometry intact so that Tommy can push.
I mean, we should bear in mind here that this is Tommy's first ever time on the Safari, isn't it? And, you know, being a reasonably typical Finn, he kind of only knows one approach to rallies. Is that fair?
Yeah, and that hits it right in the head, really. I think that it became clear, you know, because we took a Group A recce car and a Group A test car out there. We were running the cars, incredible amount of mileages, and we were getting, you know, fantastic feedback really early on to try and think about what we had to do. But Tommy's approach was, you know, he was driving quicker than what we probably would have negated what he needed to do.
Yeah.
But he's super competitive. I mean, you could see how quick he was in 95. So we got to a point where we were changing corners and uprights during the recce at the lunch break just to keep the car fresh for him. And back in the workshop, became evident that we were going to be short of bearings, and I went, we called back to Andrew to ask him to bring a load more bearings out for the event. And then it became clear that if we would have to be doing much more, you know, routine service to keep the car going to get to the finish.
Yeah.
But then the penny kind of dropped that if we could give Tommy a almost near new car before we started, you know, we had a better chance of getting to the finish in a half decent position, whether it was first, second, third or fourth, you know, that was the concept of it. But it meant that, you know, we had to do these, you know, maybe major changes in 20 minutes. So looking at, you know, car coming in, trying to check whether a lateral or a train limit was bent, it was deemed quite quickly that it was quicker just to change the corner, that, yeah, from our point of view. So went on the campaign of practicing in the workshop with the mechanics, two on each corner, to make sure they could change a corner, which wasn't easy with the old car, especially on the rear with the bag, what we called the bagpipes. It was a lower lateral training link, upper link, toe link, upright, and damper. You know, to try and do that in 20 minutes is, and track it back up again. That was one of the key factors. We could see that we had to have the car track when it left for such a high speed event. You could not have the driver feeling like the car was wandering.
No.
So we practiced and had a meeting with Lassie and Tommy and before the event, and we kind of flipped around. It was like, okay, we're going to give you a brand new car and it's going to help us from our side. We'll change the way we operate. I left somebody back in the workshop, Kevin McKenzie, to rebuild all the suspension. That was the idea. But then we were quite clear that we had to then change the, after the recce and the test, we were clear that we had to change the actual damper fluid. So it meant a strip of the dampers. But again, we were going to give Kent, we were going to give Tommy a, you know, a brand new car every single time we saw him. So it was, we were driven into that position, but also it was kind of a real big team effort, because Tommy came in, handed the car to us, and it was up to us to get the car back out to him in the 20 minutes. So in the end, the boys were getting down, changing everything complete and refitting everything and tracking in like 12 or 13 minutes.
That's incredible. You would have been snookered though, wouldn't you, if he'd come in with an engine problem as well?
We saw that we had a few other issues like that in 98 that we'll probably talk about a bit later. But it was, we had enough people to just make sure that, you know, there was eight people on the corners, and we had, you know, specialists. But our specialists could also work on the car. And one of the key factors was we planned and practiced and practiced on the test and recce car that everybody could change a corner, including myself. So it was an important element to try and make sure we were completely covered. So starting the event, we had this philosophy of going in there, but obviously the Japanese team were in the workshop and their car was like bulletproof, and they were just going home early, and, you know, we were working well into the night, every single night, to keep everything going and to rebuild stuff and to plan how we were going to do it. We had a runner vehicle that would pick the first set of dampers up and suspension arms the first service each morning and drive back to Nairobi, and the boys would start rebuilding stuff, and then we'd turn back up overnight time and help rebuild everything for the following morning. So it was a proper team effort.
And I mean, these are obviously long, long before the times where you could only have four people on a car at any one time. I mean, how many people would have been on the event in and able to work as a mechanic?
Yeah, I mean, our philosophy within Mitsubishi was we had specialists like transmission, electrician, damper guy, but we also had like a second or third tier that all worked in those departments so they could move around. But I can't remember exactly for how many we had for 96, but for 98, we definitely had 28 mechanics there with the specialists. So there was, in theory, there was 14 people per car in 98. I think probably for 96, we had at least 14, 15 per, out there for that period. So, you know, as I said, eight of those people were busy every single service. Plus we had three people back in the workshop. There's 11 plus there's probably five or six others. So, you know, it was busy all the time into the night.
And just, I mean, having the sort of foresight to get the dampers away back to the place in Nairobi or wherever, to get them rebuilt ready for the next day, you know, it's a tremendous effort. How important was Andrew Cowan in there? Because like you said, you know, he had a great experience of this kind of this style of rallies. Was he a real sort of general in the operation, or did he sort of sit back a bit and let you all get on with it?
Andrew's the figurehead. Andrew got he would pick his moment to say the right thing to people, which was for me was a great leader. You know, he came out when the rally was just starting, and I remember calling him on the phone and asking him to bring out 200 rose joint bearings with him and carry, and he had to check him in and carry him onto the plane. Yeah. And at that time, you know, Andrew was like, yeah, you must be joking, you know, what do you want all these bearings for, and why are we using all these bits? And you know, I ended that conversation by saying, do you want to win this rally or not? Yeah. And he was like, well, and it's like, and he, you know, he's good as gold, but he was a brilliant guy to work with. He had all that experience with Safari. He could talk to a driver that, you know, he could relate to them. But on our side of it, from the servicing side, it was almost like, you know, you're not in, you're all in. And when you're all in, you have to pull out every stop you can to, you know, to get that car to the finish. But also, you know, we also had a lot of pride in trying to do the best for Mitsubishi, for rally art, but every single member of the team had that mentality. So Andrew, when times were tough, when we were in the workshop at three to five in the morning, when we didn't sleep all night, he'd always pick his time to speak to people and to give them that little bit of a, you know, a pep talk or a bit of encouragement, and he was brilliant at that.
But this was 96, and this is the year that Toyota was excluded from the World Championship for their misdemeanors in Spain the previous season with the turbocharger. Ian Duncan was there, though, wasn't he, in what would have been essentially a factory Toyota. Do you think in some ways did it diminish from the result that Toyota wasn't there as the works force, or, you know, you were still racing Duncan, weren't you?
Yeah, we were, but I mean, it's horses for courses in theory. I mean, Ford were there with a big onslaught, and Subaru obviously, you know, they were there and they were pushing very hard to, you know, to try and to win the event. Kenneth was with them, and he was, you know, vastly experienced driver. So, you know, we could see Colin and Kenneth and Liatti, three car Subaru team, and Ian Duncan. And then obviously Stig was driving for Ford as well, you know, and Carlos. So there was enough in depth for us to turn up on the first event worrying whether, you know, the target was to minimum to get on the podium. That was the idea. But, you know, during the event, it completely flipped around. I remember the first service point, because we'd gone to service, we were into, you know, the normal 20-minute service during the day, which is bloody short time when you think that, you know, what you've got, you know, what event you're on, you know. Yes. So we got to the first service, and we laid everything out, and Subaru were servicing next to us. And we started changing every corner. I can remember, I won't name who they were, but there was a couple of senior Subaru management that were looking across and smiling, thinking that we were hitting massive problems. Yeah. And the car left, and then the car came back in for the second service at the same location, Alta Pessi, and we did the same thing, and then I could see the penny drop on, well, it's Mr. Richard's face, and I think he suddenly realised what we were doing, and we changed the philosophy. Everybody followed us to try and do the same thing after the following year. So, but it was tough. We were using a helicopter to fly the dampers back after the last service to get rebuilds. During the rally, I was stripping rear dampers with some of the boys. We were sending the rest back to the hotel, but the damper boys took the punishment for that one. We were up for 3 days in theory. So. But, you know, it was a massive result at the end of it, because we kind of dominated it in some respects from early on. So Tommy's driving was second to none. You know, the more the recce went on, the more the test went on, the more he understood how to hit the ravines and where to place the car and how much to brake. And, you know, it was a global effort from everybody, and I can tell you now 100% that the last service point, which was a splash and dash, there was not one person there. If they tell you differently, they were all got tears in their eyes because they suddenly realised what they'd achieved with the effort they put in. So It was pretty rewarding.
And that's the thing. I mean, we shouldn't, you know, as a team, it was a magnificent effort. But from a driver's perspective, there is a very specific way of driving this event, isn't the Safari? You know, it's, you can't go at it hell for leather. You've got to learn where to come down into first gear. I remember Nicky Griss telling me that, you know, when he started working with Colin, it was very difficult to get Colin slowed down enough. And in the end, Nicky said they agreed to put the word stop in the notes. And it was literally a, you know, you required that word, you know, the sort of severity of stop to really bring you down into first gear and actually slow the car sufficiently. That wasn't Tommy's style. And the fact that he could, we've touched on this already briefly, the fact that he could tailor his driving style to that event so quickly was, you know, I mean, looking at the times, he was quickest on the second section, wasn't he? I mean, that's impressive.
Yeah, that was, you know, and also, you know, there was some guidance as well from Sepp Arian, who'd obviously been in there with the Group B, with Salonen. And so,
yeah.
But Lassie's input was good, but we haven't really broadcast this, but we used, in later years, we even used the roadbook to actually split time. We had two helicopters in later years. That year we had a single helicopter with Lassie in, and that, you know, you could drop out of the air and, you know, change tyres at that point for the cars. It was open, but you'd use the spotters to try and guide the pace in the competitive sections as well. So, you know, we tried every angle we could to try and, you know, help Tommy out. But as I said, the more that the event went on, the more you learn. You know, you've got to give the event respect, else you're not going to get out of there. You know, the first service, you would always see that the front windscreen had cracked because they push and push to where it felt it was too much. And then when the cracking of windscreen happened, then you roughly knew that you were probably on the limit. So it was, everything was really tried. We tried everything we possibly could to try and help out. But Tommy's pace, you know, if Ryan never got to a point where you could actually physically feel what it's like to be in a car with one of the top drivers, it would blow your mind. And seeing him, Tommy, on the test there, he was incredibly quick. But as I say, you have to show the event some respect to get results out of it.
Yeah, and that, just talk us through a little bit more, you know, from the spotter helicopter, how do you guide the pace? Because, you know, we know the stories of the spotter that is up there to look for the elephants and the animals running across the road, or you know, a slower car in front. But what would the guy in the heli be saying? You know, it's quicker here, or how would that work?
The key points you've got is if you're starting first on a road, it's slightly different. If you're starting further back, you can see the helicopters in front of you. So
yeah.
Once you get a guide of where roughly they are on the road and the speed that you're going along, you can work out really quickly whether you're catching a car in front or whether you're dropping behind. So that's your first visual thing. Then you have to be, you know, you have to have two sets of eyes. You're looking down to make sure there's not going to be an animal come out of the bushes that are on the side of the road. And then you're also trying to look at, you know, to gauge whether or not you're catching a car in front. And then you can start. We had an open channel. We could talk between the helicopters. So you could ask, you know, if it's Mr. Riddle in the helicopter in front from Subaru, you could ask him if he could put, you know, you're giving him warning that you're catching the car in front. So but the helicopter itself was three purposes. It was a spotter for safety. Yeah. It wasn't just wild animals that you'd actually come across. A lot of people probably don't realise, but Safari Rally was open roads. It wasn't closed sections. So you can come into Nakuru or places like this, you come on the link sections in there pretty quick, and you can have buses on the road. So you'll call in which way you want to keep it, the bus, the people are there, you're spotting for that no one's going to run across, people on bikes, you know, young kids that are there.
I've got to say, Derek, just at this point, that would blow a lot of our younger listeners' minds, the fact that they would come into these villages flat out. And you know, there was no speed restriction. It was just part of the section. And, you know, obviously the drivers drove those sections with an awful lot more care and, you know, using their eyes more to look for people crossing the road. But it's bonkers, isn't it, in this day and age, to think that you were in a helicopter saying, look out for the school bus, he's on the left, go to the right. It's mad.
Yeah, I mean, some of the McLean photos you'll see from the period, there's some of them through the villages, and you can see some of the people still on the side of the road. It's totally crazy, you know. It's at the time, you know, there's two ways of looking at it. Safari was such a massive thing that people knew what was going on, but you know, you've stood in the stages. If you're downwind of a rally car, you don't hear it come past you until it's past you. So, you know, the helicopter above the car, you know, gives a warning to the locals that there's a rally car approaching at high speed. And we'd use the helicopter during the test as well. So, you know, that whole philosophy was there. But, you know, we always had a doctor in the helicopter. We always had a spotter. We had one mechanic, and we had a spare wheel and some tools. And we were very lucky to have a very good pilot. Charles was one of our pilots. That was ex-President Moy military pilot, and we always used the same helicopter at Wilson Airport in Nairobi, and he was part of a very, very important part of the team. He could fly sideways, he could come across, he could look, he'd be an extra set of eyes to spot something coming out. So you've got a good bit of language between the three of you in the helicopter, and we always made sure that where possible the doctor was trying to look out for stuff as well. So
how much chatter was there between the heli and the car? You know, on a minute by minute, would it be one call per minute, or would you, you know, could there be 10 minutes with silence? Or
I mean, you could see some of the sections are 100 kilometers long. You know, that first, the second section, I think on 96, was we'd always based our ideas on keeping the car together for 120k. The first section was a short section, maybe 50, 60 kilometers. The second was over 100 kilometers. So, you know, you'd probably call. It depends on how many animals were there. If you're first car on the road, obviously you're clearing a lot of the animals out of the way as well. So, depending on what was there, but you know, you are talking to the drivers, and you are telling him whether or not you're catching. And then, of course, you know, the downside is that they're obviously calling the notes, and the notes are not the same as what you get with the European event. There's some more gaps in it. So, but then once the driver starts catching the driver, you're starting to get, you know, you've been asked, have you talked to the helicopter in front? Are they going to stop? Are they going to pull over? You know, you've always got that banter coming back as well. So it's always interesting.
And when you did see animals, sometimes the heli would be a bit further ahead of the car. And you try and drop down, and if there were a herd of elephants, you try and move them, essentially by.
Yeah, I mean, it was the pilot's job to spot a group of animals. If there was a problem with a group of animals in front, he'd go straight away. He'd leave the car, and he'd go and try and buzz them. Generally, you try and sit above, because you're so much higher. You're sitting on the road and you're looking down. So he's in two positions. He can either move forward to move animals. He can move forward to warn, you know, the spectators there, which we have done in the past. But generally, he's overviewing and trying to look from left and right to see what's coming towards the road. So, you know, the animals themselves, whether they're, you know, giraffes or elephants or whatever they are, they normally move in a lateral movement across the road. So, you know, you do have, it's the small animals, the dogs, and birds like gazelles that can hit the screen and shatter the screen and end up in the car through the roof scoop. There's things like that you're trying to avoid if possible.
Yeah, but I got to say, you know, this, just talking to you now, it almost gives me goosebumps. You know, Safari is an event I absolutely love, and that job must have been one of, you know, apart from driving and co-driving, that must have been one of the most exciting jobs, to be in the heli on an event like that, because you were so integral to the actual competition, weren't you?
Yeah, it's there's so many elements to it. I mean, the strange thing is we talked about, you know, telling some of the stories of these events, and I rewrote some of the notes from it, which, you know, you completely forgot about. You know, you forgot about having to go in the middle of nowhere and drop fuel drums of aviation fuel to make sure the chopper can be refueled. You know, we ended up jump starting a helicopter at one service point because the pilot left the actual things, or the center panel fired up. You know, there's so many things involved. I can remember the first event, first time we were there, first part of the test, we wanted to see how much spare parts we could take in to the helicopter with the pilot and the spotter and the mechanic and the doctor. And we had this great long big list of parts we wanted to take, and it was like a tenth 10% of that, because obviously, you know, Nairobi's at altitude.
Yeah.
You've got to make sure the helicopter can take off. So this is no word of a lie. One of the legs we knew we were going to, you know, it was a rough section. We had the helicopter hovering before we put the parts in, and then the helicopter took off. So
seriously?
We tried. We did everything in February.
Wow. You've got to be a fairly brave man to jump in that heli as well. These are incredible memories. And tell us about, you know, the actual achievement of getting to the finish and winning the event. It must have been an enormous emotional moment for the whole team.
I think because we were so busy with keeping everything going, back then my job was to look after the service with Molly, and basically, you know, all the parts supply and, you know, the tires and having everything in the right place. Yeah. Alistair Roberts was the controller, but it was like, you know, we physically had to keep the ball rolling in some respects. And it was, you almost like ignored the fact that you were doing quite well in the event, to be honest with you, because your first thing was to survive the event and get through the event.
Yeah.
So when we were going along and, you know, we were fastest on the second section and Tommy was getting quite clear, you know, for me, that because the rally was three legs long that year, it was a shorter event. It was, I think it was 650, 660 kilometres long, which is long compared to today's events, but it was shorter compared with others. It was almost like three rallies within a rally. So getting through the first event. And then, you know, if you can think as well, when you finish the last section coming back into Nairobi at the end of each leg, you'd have 2 hours in the workshop before you had to check in. So you'd come down the road section, even if you're like 30 kilometres off the route, you'd dive into your workshop. There'd be a massive onslaught to get the car turned around and back out again. So not only are you servicing in the field, but there's like a, you know, galloping down the road to get in front of the car before the last service. Helicopters landing with parts, and so there was so much going on. You ignored the result, but going into the last day, it was like almost ticking off the stages. The last but one stage that year was 210 kilometers long, and for me that was like the, you know, if we get that, we have to get through that stage. We have to get through that stage, and you kept on saying you have to get through that stage, and. The last one was still like 80 odd kilometres or something. I think it was Orta Pessi, the last stage. You're almost biting your nails, but you're also ignoring it, knowing that you've got to get the car through. So, but when we got to that last splash and dash fuel after the stage to get into Nairobi, I swear there was nobody that wasn't crying at that service. They realised what had gone on. I didn't see Tommy until the night time back at the service, because we were then into getting all the vans back, and we had to start getting stuff taken out of the cars for the next event. But that night in the hotel, we were stopping at the Serena Lodge. I don't think I had a dry piece of clothing on the next day. I was chucked in the pool, I think, three times. Everybody ended up in the pool.
Yeah.
You've seen the famous McLean pictures from Toyota that were just a beyond Vordegarden. It seemed like a ritual out there. But it was kind of disbelief. I didn't really believe that we'd won the event until I got back to the hotel that night. And it, for me, with the challenges that we had and having to, you know, firefight on an hourly basis for those 4 or 5 weeks, it was so rewarding. It really was. And Tommy came around and thanked everybody. I still think he was in disbelief. But for Mitsubishi, it was a massive, massive victory. I felt sorry for Kenjiro and the TUS team. You know, they'd struggled along for so many years, and they were part of the team anyway. They celebrated with us. But it wasn't ideal that we came in and won it first time. But I think we changed so many things about how teams looked at Safari. What we changed during the day. Yeah. I mean, you know, it was a. I think that catalyst then made it like, you know, you almost wanted to, straight away, you wanted to come back the following year and win that event. And it became very important to Mitsubishi that we were successful in the future.
Yes. Yeah. And it, I mean, fair dues. It was, you know, you talk about Shinazuki, you beat them by 2 hours and you beat everybody by 14 minutes. You know, Kenneth Erickson was second for Subaru. That, in an event that took more than 12 hours, nearly 13 hours, still a 14-minute win is worth having, isn't it, in Safari?
It was good. It was basically about 14 minutes. Isn't a long time in Safari. So you know, even carrying the lead into the last leg, it wasn't enough. It's never enough. You know, we carried two spares, so you know, getting the first spare out of the car is fine. Getting the second spare out of the car is not ideal coming across. So, you know, two punches on a section, you could drop 10 minutes easy.
Yeah, and so one thing I remember from coming back from Kenya is, you know, you almost go into decompression. This kind of, because it is this other world that you live in, and you know, you're so involved in a rally and everything. And to come back to Europe, it's quite different, isn't it? And that's for me, you know, after a week or 10 days out there. But you were out there for 6 weeks or something. How, you know, how did you reacclimatize to normal life?
I think the thing for me, it's really difficult, like looking back now on the events. I mean, you have to look, you know, it becomes a bit of a muddle until you actually look at like a planner or what we did for that year. In 95 we basically pushed. 96 we'd taken on specialist drivers, so we were chopping and changing around. You were just coming back and then straight into the next event, really, because what people don't see is you know you've got a test, then a recce, then a rally in between every event. So we got, you know, in 96 we were doing Hong Kong Beijing rally and Asian Pacific rounds, so you know, we had a massive program that wasn't generally just on World Championship. We were doing the events that, you know, was important to Mitsubishi Motors. So you know, that year, which we'll talk about later, my next, you know, big project with the long haul events, and also Hong Kong Beijing, which logistically was like moving the British Army in some respects. Yeah. So you came out of this one and you're into the next one, but it felt good for a long time, that event win. It really did.
I bet, because, you know, we shouldn't forget that obviously 95 had been Colin McRae's year, and 96 the start for sure. It was, you know, Tommy won Sweden, which was the opening round in 96, and then this Safari, it was two from two, wasn't it?
Yeah, and you know, I did all the prep for Sweden and then flew straight to Kenya whilst Sweden was on, so, and we couldn't get results from anybody.
I mean, oh, really?
The fax machine was our form of contact at that point, and it was, if you could get a line out every 20 times, you were lucky. So I remember getting the message through, and then the fax through from our PR people. It was a massive result, but we were unlucky in 95 to some degree. But it also, I think that I'm glad we came through 95 and into the start of 96 the way we did, because it, you know, we were seen as like the, you know, the third tier team by some of the other teams, you know, with much bigger budgets, and we did have the smallest budget, so we kind of, you know, Andrew spent the money wisely, and you know, he always questioned if I was ordering parts. You know, you go into the office and you'd have to justify ordering, you know, 120 Lobo joints and 240 rear Lobo joints. You'd have to write out what event it was for and schedule change. But we spent the money wisely, and when we went to Safari, you know, not having a big budget, we had to think a bit more rather than buy our way out of the problems.
But it was difficult because, you know, Andrew Cowan was a little bit under pressure from Japan to focus more on Asia Pacific at that time, wasn't it? That was where the market was, and you know, Asia Pacific Championship in the mid 90s was huge, you know, with Subaru and the 555 money and all of that. It was a very different environment, wasn't it?
Massively different. And again, you know, it's difficult unless you're involved in it. You don't see what the, you know, what, where the launches are and where, how is it, what's important. As I said before, you know, Asian Pacific were massive. Hong Kong Beijing was incredibly important for them to do well in, because of the, you know, the Subaru battle and the 555 battle, but also, you know, we had this, you know, this checklist of Monte Carlo, Greece, Finland, Rally GB. They were incredibly important for as marquee events that Mitsubishi wanted to do extremely well in, and you know, the you know, ultimately they wanted to win the world championship. So that was, you know, we tiered up over from 95 to 98. We kind of went at the running board, but it was not easy to keep everything running with the Nation Pacific program and Hong Kong Beijing and the world championship.
Yeah. I mean, maybe that to move now into Hong Kong Beijing, you know, that's, it's not an event I know a huge amount about, but it, like you say, it was a really big deal. Tell us more, you know, why did it mean so much, and why was it logistically such a big challenge? You entered a lot of cars there, didn't you, that year?
Yeah, 96 again, we entered three cars. Again, you know, we had our affiliation with Kenjiro,
yeah,
who'd done the event before, and he was being run, he's, you know, been run by Rally Art Japan with support from Rally Art Australia with that car normally. So when we'd gone to Hong Kong Beijing the year before, and it wasn't a brilliant event. So again, you know, you learn from what happens. But we went there with Ari Vatanen, the legend,
yeah,
and Richard Burns supporting. Well, they weren't really supporting anybody. They were both number one drivers in theory. But we went with three cars, which logistically meant, you know, we had because the nature of the event, it's a 7-day rally. It's extremely challenging for a number of reasons, from road surface to conditions to the environment to, but you're driving from Hong Kong, Beijing, from Hong Kong into China on the first day, and then you drive straight through in a straight line right away, right through to Beijing. And you know, it's a separate service, overnight halts, separate hotels every night. You have to, and when you leave in Hong Kong, you have to carry everything with you for those 7 days: fuel, tires, spares, luggage for the drivers, everything.
That linear route is logistically, it must have been a nightmare, because, you know, and a nightmare to do in Europe, but let alone, you know, to do it where the language is so entirely different, and, you know, the written language is hieroglyphics to us, to actually prepare everything to do that is a massive job, isn't it? And just to know that everything, you know, if you leave something behind, you're not going to see it again.
That's right. I mean, again, we were in 96, we were taking you know, service vehicles were coming from the world championship, and also, which were the, you know, the burger vans we called them at the time, but also, you know, we had dedicated vehicles that we bought out there for it. So we ended up having over 30 service vehicles with the management vehicles for that event to run the three cars. So it was 80 plus people. So, but with that, again, I imagine not a lot of people know it, but every service vehicle is actually physically entered in the rally in some respects for insurance purposes. So we had two girls in with Rally Art Hong Kong, Amos Xu and Kimmy Ho. They spent 3 months doing all the permits and paperwork and vehicle entries to get into China. It was a massive, massive, wow, just a thing from their point of view, just to get us to the starting ramp in theory. So yeah, we used the, we were fortunate, we used the British Army Gurkha camp in Kowloon as our base of operations. It's quite a kind of good term. But I did all the preparations out there, and we had a really good relationship with the adjutant who ran the barracks, and we could eat at the canteen each day. So we were driving 40 minutes from the centre of Hong Kong each morning in minibuses to start work, and then work all day there, and then come back of an evening. But as I said, it was a mammoth exercise to bring all the vehicles from the port, even load them all up, make sure we had everything, and we had the assistance of Rally Art Australia, and obviously Rally Art Hong Kong for that event. So it was incredibly different. I think we had 350 wheels and tires built before the event started out. Michelin flew two technicians out to fit tires. Every vehicle, you know, silly things like we'd have to you know, write whether it's petrol or diesel in Chinese on the petrol cap, so that when you got to the fuel halts, you didn't get the wrong fuel put in there. You know, there were so many things that went on. But the strange thing is, you know, like looking back at it now, Wuhan, where obviously this coronavirus maybe started, was the overnight halt on the fourth night.
Really?
Yeah, we actually stopped in Wuhan. It was, from what I can remember, from what I can remember, is a massive, massive, it was one of the massive towns that we stopped at. And there's a pretty good story with it. Was, once the rally starts, you don't see the car until, you know, you may do one service a day on the side of the road, and your main aim is to get to the end of the leg. And you will drive literally 17 hours a day to get to the overnight halt. So we were starting at 2 a.m. in the morning. You know, being British, we'd try and stop about 6, 7 o'clock in the morning when it's just light to get a quick cup of tea, and then you'd be on the road again. You know? So, but going into Wuhan, the crowds were so crazy that the actual rally cars were struggling to get to the service halt. And then when they did, you know, if you've seen the rally car in the morning, you're trying to catch up with the car because it's zooming off the route and doing the stages and coming back on and keep going. It doesn't stop. And we were struggling to get the service vehicles to the end of the leg. I remember one evening we made it through with one van, and the three cars turned up in convoy, and we had no mechanics. So Harry was the total professional. He basically came over, you know, there's nowhere for them to sit. They were just waiting. And he goes, "What can I do?" And he'd hit something in the stage, and the door was buckled in. He couldn't open the door properly. I said, "Do me a favor, take the door panel off, and then we'll have a look at it. And then, you know, we'll carry on checking the cars." It was 2 hour plus service. I said, "The boys will turn up at some point." And, you know, they started to come through about after an hour. But, you know, he's good as gold. He took the panel off. He pushed the door panel out. He put the handle back on. He re-put the panel back on. He came back. He asked what he could do. He got the fuel drum. He refueled the three cars for us. He was brilliant, and that was that mentality that we needed to try and, you know, to try and get through that event. The service vans, you know, the service briefing, we'd send out, I think, Alistair Roberts and Ken Rees from Subaru went out with Kimmy Ho and Amos Yu to do a full recce of that route to work out where we were going to service. But it became very clear that, you know, you couldn't afford to lose a van out there. You'd never see it again. So it was imperative that everybody made it through each day and through the end to the end of the rally.
And like you say, such an adventure, you know, driving 17 hours a day to get from place to place. It's like a kind of a Dakar, isn't it? I mean, that's the only kind of way that you can talk about this thing. You talk about the entering the service cars in the event. That's exactly what they do on that event, isn't it?
Yeah, it's similar format. I mean, I'd look back at it before, and I don't know if you remember, Andy Dawson went out there a long time ago with the Fords, and Toyota went there for a few years with Beyond. And the event was like real, you know, you've really got, it's one of those events you're learning so much as you go along. I mean, you wouldn't have like a bivouac like do with Dakar. You'd have a hotel, and but it was such a long day. You'd get to the hotel maybe at 10 o'clock at night after you've done your restock, and you've moved tires around and worked out who's used what. And there'd be a big banquet table in the middle of the hotel, and it's like a buffet. You went and picked out what you wanted, but everything is, you can imagine, it was back in 96, it was just local food. So you ended up picking rice. And what, you know, I used to go for the white meat, chicken. Yeah. And I found out the following morning from AMYSU, the local, he goes, "Oh," I said, "how's the food?" I said, "Oh, you know, it was okay, I had chicken." And he looked at me and he goes, "Chicken?" I goes, "Yeah." He says, "Oh, strange, I didn't see any chicken." And we were at 2 o'clock in the morning, and we were loading the vans to go, and, you know, just checking everybody was up, and everybody starts moving out, and there's a security guard in the car park shooting rats with a pellet gun. And Amos, you come out, and he goes, there's your chicken. I go, "Sorry." He goes, "Yeah, they just boil them, skin them, and they take the white meat and put it on a plate." So I had rat at the hotel. So
how was it? Can you remember?
It didn't. I mean, 17 hours driving. We had food packs, so we gave everybody, when we started the rally, everybody had a food pack per day per crew. But you got fed up with the food packs after like 3 or 4 days. So this chicken seemed like a luxury. So it wasn't chicken. That was unfortunate. But the hotels, you'd have a good hotel or a bad hotel. The one night that year, I think it was day two. Shoji, who I mentioned earlier from Tusk Engineering, come out, and he got a Japanese film crew with him, and he goes, oh, come in, have a look. And there was rats running up and down the staircase and running underneath the doors into the room. So I got the boys together. I said, you know, wash, shower, whatever you want to do, but I recommend that we sleep in the vans tonight. And we take in sleeping bags for everybody. And that's what we did on that one event. So some of the hotels were fine, but, you know, you've got to look back over those years. It was... It was a full communist state back then. I don't think you'd ever get the access we got to drive through the country like you do nowadays. Or if you did, it'd be very limited. You know, well, the national news media would probably be able to do it. But we had secret police following us. They'd stop at the hotel each night in grey suits, and then they'd get in the car and follow us during the day. And we had them with us for like 3 or 4 days. And those guys were like absolutely shattered by the end of it. They were sleeping in reception. But, you know, there was a lot of state control still back then. So there were so many different elements that were going on. But, you know, fundamentally, it was a rough, you know, you were driving for 7 days. The terrain changed. You were in mountainous areas. You were in fast, wide areas. You were in sections that were like Greece, that were rough. It was very clear. It was a very polluted road. There was a lot of rain there. So I remember the day before the rally started, we made the call that we, because logistically it was going to be difficult, we made the call to cut every tyre, do like an outside cut to try and sweep some of the loose gravel off the surface.
Yeah.
It meant the two Michelin guys, and one of them had got food poisoning. Meant that two of the Michelin guys and myself ended up cutting 300 wheels and tyres. So... it was a busy day, but you know, there was loads of things like that happened. You know, we carried all the fuel with us. We moving parts around.
Again, that, Derek, you know, just carrying the fuel with you. You know, that it just doesn't happen these days, does it?
No. I mean, we I can say now we ended up mixing the fuel to just, it was still legal, but it gave it a bit more octane. So we'd have the whole process of decanting fuel drums, put, you know, before we started the Kowloon, and then redoing the fuel, and every van carried an emergency set of wheels and tires in case another van never made the service. Everybody carried fuel. We were carrying a tin of fuel in the mechanics chase cars. The mechanics chase cars were then picking up the gravel notes and sometimes driving back down the stage. And you know, it was the loads that went on. It was crazy.
Yeah, it was. But as we said at the top of this Hong Kong Beijing story, it was a great event for Mitsubishi, wasn't it? There was a 1-2-3 there with Vatanen leading.
And yeah, and that was, you know, with Kenneth and Piera that year both crashed out. Before that happened, we were quite strong anyway. You know, Ari's a perfect gentleman. He was. You know, he'd driven with the Gallant for Mitsubishi. He was an ambassador for Mitsubishi. He was, him and Richard were really trading times. I mean, if you get a chance to look back at some of the videos of the event, there's some online now. There, you know, you could see that it was a very quick event. Kanjiro still held close. He was only 20 minutes behind at the end. So, but after Kenneth crashed out, I think that. You know, we kind of like half lifted the foot.
Yeah.
But it was, you know, obviously with all the sponsorship going on, wherever you went, you've got 555 and Subaru banners everywhere lining the route to get the cars onto Chinaman Square at the finish. That's where the finish was. You finished the rally through the Great Wall. It was the last tarmac stage. So you did a tarmac stage through the wall and across the dam. And then you drove in the convoy to Tiananmen Square. Obviously, the big pictures, you know, on the ramp there. Mm. But for Mitsubishi, it was massive. It was 1-2-3-4.
Yeah, and just quickly to touch on, obviously, Richard had come to he'd won his first APRC round in New Zealand just before that, hadn't he? Or was it before Australia? There was Australia, then Hong Kong.
Yeah. Yeah. Richard was. I mean, Richard even came to Safari with us the year before. So that year, he was basically running the crap. We put him in the gravel car with Mike Stewart. Richard, we saw him as a as a big option. We watched, you know, we're looking for another driver to support Tommy, and we'd use specialists in 95, Agini and Kenneth. You know, it wasn't the same. It wasn't consistent enough with enough seat time to push for the manufacturer's title. So 96 for us was that first idea of trying to get, you know, a driver's championship, which obviously we were successful with Tommy, but also further down the line to try and secure the manufacturer's title for Mitsubishi. And we didn't think that would come straight away, but the planning was there to try and make that happen. So we were very good to work with Richard and Robert. There were, I think, fair to say that they'd basically come from Subaru and they knew they'd been treated a Subaru way. And when they came to us, we kind of treated them in a Rally Art way. So yeah. it was very refreshing to work with them. And there was a great balance between Tommy and Richard. But on that event, obviously, Ari was like, you know, Mr. Perfect, and Tilbur was co-driving. So, that was I think Richard struggled a bit with confidence against Tommy's pace when he came into the team. We changed a few things around in New Zealand on the Asia-Pacific round, and he won that event. And we kind of like almost like fudged him into getting a result there. But you could see that we had a really good option with both drivers there.
Yeah, and Christian Tilber there, you're talking about Vatanen's co-driver. He was a hugely experienced fella in that part of the world, wasn't he, on those style of events?
Yeah, Dakar and everything. You know, he was, Ari partnered with Richard a number of times, but for that event, Tilber came in very good. Very good at, judging the pace. But I think in the end, I think that, the pace was basically, to start off with, was incredibly quick until the two, Kenneth and Piero had crashed out for Subaru. So they kind of backed off. But yeah, we brought him in. He was great. He was a great ambassador. He was also really good experience. And then, of course, Kanjiro also had done the event before. And, you know, we took some of his input and knowledge. And, you know, we always included the Kenjiro and all the actual Tusk boys, Nishigura and everything, as part of the team. So it was a 1-2-3 for Mitsubishi.
So there we are. That's Safari 96, Hong Kong, Beijing 96. Great, great stories. That's just the beginning of some of these amazing stories that Derek's got to tell us. Next week, we're going to jump forward 2 years to Safari Rally 98, which British rally fans, very special event for us, because it, Richard Burns' first ever World Rally Championship win. Not just Richard Burns, Robert Reed, of course, as well. And then a very special treat for everybody. We're going to get Derek's take on the 1998 RAC Rally. And if you need me to let you know the significance of that event for Tommy Mäkinen and a certain Spaniard called King Carlos, then perhaps you're listening to the wrong podcast. Anyway, thank you very much for joining us this week. Thanks to Derek, and we will see you next week. Take care. Bye-bye.